Ms. Bieberfeld is a clinical psychologist. She has extensive experience both in the Jewish world and the secular world in the clinical realm with all ages, and her subspecialties in parental counseling. So tonight she'll be speaking on the topic of developing positive self-esteem and coping with peer pressure. So without further ado, Dr. Bieberfeld.
The task for today is actually for tonight, this evening, is rather daunting, especially after you've been sitting on traffic on the FDR drive for quite a while with your gas light blinking at you because you weren't smart enough to put gas in the tank before you left Brooklyn. Not my self-esteem strong enough to take it. I didn't know if the car was, but we're going to be talking about two different things and their connection, basically. And I'm going to work very hard at making it one lecture rather than, quote unquote, two separate ones with a comma in between them, because they really are very connected. The issue of enhancing our children, I don't even know what the flyer says, truthfully. What does it say? It says, developing positive self-esteem and coping with peer pressure. That sounds good. I'm going to be discussing, first of all, the issue of enhancing our children's self-esteem. Most of what I'm saying really applies to all ages and can be fit to whatever age children, you know, you're dealing with. And I'll go through, I'm going to be mindful of the clock, the watch, because I want to leave enough time for questions at the end. And at some point, whether I've actually finished what I want to say or not, there is a clock there, okay. I'm going to switch over to the whole issue of peer pressure, and what we need to know about it, how to help our children with it, and what's the connection, which on some level is obvious, but we'll go into a little more detail, between positive self-esteem and coping with peer pressure. So I guess the first question that I have, and you have some of the handouts, and we're going to be going according to, you know, the first handout is helping our children develop and maintain positive self-esteem. Is self-esteem and self-worth, are they the same or are they different? Self-esteem is basically an appraisal of oneself in regard to something else. Meaning, if I'm a good, basketball player, if I'm good at spelling tests, if I'm good at something, then that should help my self-esteem in some way. And we'll talk a lot more about that. What is self-worth? And what's the difference between them? Self-worth, as far as I'm concerned, is a building block. It's a foundation. Self-worth is something that every child who is born into this world deserves to have and to know that they have from the people who are the ones raising them and guiding them. You know, self-worth should not depend on intelligence, on achievement, on anything but existence. It's, you know, if you're, you know, within a Torah framework, it's actually relatively easy, because the fact is that all of us are born with a neshama, which is a chelek al-kamimal. We are a part of the Ribbono Shel Olam in some way. If that isn't enough to give us self-worth, I'm not sure what is. But the fact is, children, babies, children of all ages, including adult children, should hopefully have a sense of self-worth which transcends achievement. Meaning, I can be a lousy speller, or I can be foolish enough to leave Brooklyn without enough gas to get to Jersey, but I don't know exactly where I'm going, and I thought traffic would be lighter, and hopefully that shouldn't essentially touch my sense of self-worth, even if it doesn't do great things for my self-esteem temporarily. That sense of self-worth is a building block. I both believe it and I see it over and over again in my practice when I deal with, and at this point I'm not dealing with younger children as much as I used to, but I'm dealing with teenagers, young adults, married women, who, for whatever the issues are coming from backgrounds where their parents were not able to provide for them that innate sense of I'm worth something. There are people who believe in me. There are people who become happy when they see me just because I am, and how things built on top of that. And there is work that can be done to help correct that. But things built on top of that without dealing with that core issue of not having that sense of self are going to crumble. I've met many clients who are very accomplished, who are highly intelligent, who are ambitious, they're professionals, they're, you know, looking at them from the outside, you think that, wow, this is great. And yet, internally, they don't feel it. Why? Because that sense of self-worth, that building block is not there. To give you an example of what self-worth looks like between a parent and child, and it's a story I love to tell over because it was so spontaneous. It wasn't planned. This woman didn't know I was watching. When I had the ability to make it to shul, which Baruch Hashem I don't anymore since I have a little one at home who wants to go to shul but wouldn't do well if we were there for too long. There was a family that used to come on a relatively regular basis, and sometimes some of her teenage kids came first. Usually the mother ended up showing up first, and you know, one by one her teenage children would trickle in, which was pretty good because most teenage girls don't end up coming to shul altogether, at least not where I daven. And no matter where the mother was holding and davening, unless she was really smack in the middle of Shemona Esrei, whether in the middle of laning, whether she's in the middle of Psukkah Dezimra, if she saw one of her children come in, she would look up and this huge smile would cross her face. There's this huge smile. Now, the child hadn't done anything but walk in. Okay? It wasn't fake. It wasn't like, now my child has come in and so I'm going to smile at them. It was absolutely 100% real. And that's what, you know, being able to give a sense of self-worth to somebody means. And that's the bottom line. Self-esteem is what comes on top of it. We're going to talk about self-esteem most of the evening, but I can't talk about self-esteem without establishing that there's a foundation of building blocks which has to be there first, and that has nothing to do with accomplishments or anything of the sort. Now, self-esteem basically is, again, it's an appraisal and an estimation of the self. The way the world works, it's usually with regard to something else. Now, most people, I really never have met anybody to whom this doesn't apply, have some talent or another. They have something that they're good at. Is there always going to be somebody in the world who's better? Yes, there is. And that's where our job as parents comes in, in the sense that building up your child for what they can do, that doesn't mean they have to be the best at everything. I remember growing up, I had a best friend for approximately many, many years. We're still in touch, though our conversations are fewer and far between and our emails are shorter. We had many, many of the same interests for many, many years. And as we grew up, we diverged in a lot of different ways. But, my feelings for her certainly haven't changed. And the two of us, early on in grade school, there was no real competition in terms of one, you know, the two of us. Interestingly enough, though we both did very, very well in school, she was a math science person, and I was the English, Chumash person. Our strengths were very different. Our minds worked very, very differently. She can sit and do puzzles, and they'll be on me completely. And yet her father, who was a very, very good person, and I happened to love them. They were second parents to me. I called them mom and dad. She called my parents mom and dad. It was that sort of relationship. I know would often say to her, if she'd come up with a 93 on a test, what did Aviva get? And if I had gotten a 96, 97, well, where are your other 3 or 4 points? Now, she grew up extremely healthy anyway, because her household was basically healthy. I'm not sure why he used to do that, honestly. Probably because they always on the, well, she wouldn't mind hearing this, but she's not going to. A little bit on the lazy side. Didn't put in a lot of work, and probably had she worked at all, she would have gotten the 100. Forget about the 96 or the 97. Maybe that's why he did it. I don't know. But your children need to know, in terms of self-esteem, that they can work towards something. They can be good at something. They don't have to be the best. And as parents, one of the things that you're going to be work on helping them is to find their strengths, whatever they may be, and build on them. Now, in a world that we live in, which is very much school-based, that's the reality. Most of our children spend most of their day in school. For the child that's not academically inclined, it's actually quite difficult. it's really very difficult unless you have, you know, a special staff of teachers and a fair amount of extracurricular activities where people can shine in other areas. I know people who dread the school year and love the summer. Other than the fact that there's no academic pressure, you know, they shine at sports. They shine in drama. They have wonderful voices, which can come into play later on in school years, let's say, but certainly not in the earlier school years necessarily. As parents, you need to know that. You need to be helping them find what they're good at and building themselves up in terms of that they have a strength. They have something which is real and something to build on, and encourage hobbies, encourage passions, encourage things that don't have to do with homework, which I know is very is difficult in all schools in terms of the fact that our children do a lot of homework and they spend a lot of time in school, and when they're not in school, they're on the phone with their friends and, you know, whatever it is. But again, that self-esteem has to be built on that self-worth. Okay. Let's go back in terms of how do you give somebody positive self-esteem. So there's no question that there are children who are born more optimistic, more positive, and they seem to be much more sure of themselves. And yet, I wonder, I mean, you all have probably children of different ages. I don't know what age, you know, children you have. But the cycle of life that I've noticed in terms of students is that if you ask any 2 or 3-year-old if they're smart and if they're pretty and even if they're cute, if they know what that means, the answer is yes. They are. They think that they are God's gift to the world. And so they should. You ask a 6-year-old, for the most part, if they're smart and if they're pretty, and the answer is yes, though it's not as a resounding yes as it was when they were 3. You ask a 10, 11, 12-year-old, a preteen, if they think they're smart, if they think they're pretty, and the answer is usually, I don't know, you know, and my friends say I'm smart, I don't really feel so smart, or my friends say that I'm pretty, but I don't really know. You ask a 16 or 17-year-old, and the answer is smart? Pretty? So I'm not sure what's happened over the years, but something has happened. And as parents, I think we need to play an integral part in somehow preventing that from happening, whatever it is. Sometimes it's school, which isn't good for all children. And obviously, I've heard very, very good things about Yeshiva of North Jersey. I'm not talking about this school in particular. School in general is not good for a lot of children. Whether it's friendships that have changed and soured over the years, that have left kids sort of feeling less than they should about themselves. There are so many different things that can affect the child's self-esteem. And one of the things I think a parent needs to do is over the years sort of realize that the thing that may give a child self-esteem when they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old isn't going to work when they're 8 or 9 or 10. And that has to change from year to year. Let's go to point 2. I'm going to try to go in order because I can jump around and just talk about this. Just as joy and happiness are contagious, so too positive all self-esteem is contagious, which puts a tremendous burden on parents, as everything I want to talk about tonight puts a tremendous burden on parents. I think that's what you're here for, actually. That's what we're all here for. If parents have very poor self-esteem, or even mediocrely poor self-esteem, it will be very, very hard to convey to your children a positive sense of themselves. Children will see through almost any act that you put on, which is a little bit scary, but it's the truth. And so if you really, really, if your self-esteem is normal, which means it's up some days, it's down some days, you know there are things that you're good at, you know, you have your moods, but basically you're a person who understands that you have your worth, your self-worth, and there are things that you're good at, there are things you're not so good at, and, you know, you're probably, you know, there are things that you're good at that you're not the best in the world, but you're fine. I mean, you're okay with yourself on some level, then it's not that hard to transfer that to your children. If you really, on a different level, don't believe that you're okay, for whatever the reason is, then it's going to be very, very hard to transfer to your children a sense that they're really okay and build up their self-esteem. And so each parent has to sort of question themselves in this area because it is contagious. There's no question about it. If you're a positive person, your children will likely be positive people. And obviously, nature, teva, does play some role here. Children have their own personalities. But it's going to be very, very hard for a child. I mean, we know there's a lot of research about depressed parents and the effect that it has on children. That's the extreme. But let's say you're a normal, run-of-the-mill parent who has really lousy self-esteem. It's going to affect children. It's going to affect... And I find... I've met children who are having trouble socially, let's say. And yet there doesn't seem to be anything particularly wrong with them. And if you meet a parent, and the parent seems to be very unsure of themselves and isn't able to take a stand, and isn't doing a good job of directing their child in almost any way, shape, or form because of their own doubts, well, that's going to affect the child's social interactions with others because they don't have the sense from... They don't have guidance from parents. They don't have a strong parent to lean back on. And it's not being transferred in a way that the child can say, can feel good about themselves. And no matter what your teenagers say in terms of wanting to be different from you and how did I end up with you with a mother and all the things that teenagers say or preteens say, 8-year-olds say, say when they're pretty young, actually. Actually, my 3-year-old says it. You're not my mother. The fact is, they still rely on you. You're still their marking point for a lot of different things. When you're a teenager, you're their marking point for what they don't want to be very often. But that's still also important that they have somebody to judge against that they don't want to be like. Otherwise, they'd be really drifting in some ways. If you don't have confidence, but you believe that there's something you just never really thought about, you can fake it till you have it. Okay, or get yourself, and if that's not going to work, get yourself some professional help, basically. Or put yourself on a program I would say to each of you, compliment your child at least a couple of times a day. You know, even if your child is difficult and you're having trouble with them, find something good that your child has done a couple of times a day. I've had parents tell me that sometimes, particularly difficult children, that every night, they would write something and then read it back to their children, something nice their children had done. Not that necessarily that their hair looked nice that night, unless your child has an issue with real appearance, but something good in terms of mido, something that's good about what they did, something that they worked hard for, and it could be a test grade if they really worked for it, but something intrinsic to them to make them feel, and tell to them often. Let them hear from you what's good about them. Don't expect them to know what you feel. And I'm sort of skipping to number 8 on some level. You know, make sure your children know that you love them and how important they are to you. Don't assume they know it. And for some people, it's very natural to tell their children that you love them. For some people, it's natural to tell their 2- and 3-year-old they love them, and it becomes much harder when they're 7 or 8, as the children are more difficult, as they're more verbal, and as the relationship shifts. There's no age that a child doesn't need to hear from a parent that you love them, even when they sort of look at you with disdain if they're 15 or 16 and say, Ma, or whatever, something not as nice as that. You know, they need to know that you value them. They need to know that you love them. Don't assume. And don't withdraw that, even if you're angry with them. Being angry does not preclude loving them. Being upset with them, being disappointed, does not preclude believing in them. It's okay to tell your child you're disappointed, you're upset, you're frustrated, whatever it is. But at an early age, you also need to tell them that that doesn't mean that mommy or daddy or Abba, whoever it is, doesn't love you. Mommy's upset with you right now because... Well, I'll take the latest antic to, you know, adult at home, because you really shouldn't have been giving your dolls a bath in Vaseline and making a mess on the floor by trying to wash it all off afterwards. So yes, I am upset. You don't want to tell them at that moment that you love them because it's a little confusing, but at some point children do need to hear that the fact that mommy or Abba or daddy, whoever you are, I'm going to use mommy and daddy for ease's sake, is angry with you doesn't mean that love has been withdrawn. And you need to be very careful about how you deal with that in the earlier ages and as they get older. Being angry, being disappointed, being scared should not mean a withdrawal of love. Because again, then you're taking away that foundation from your children. Okay. Number 3, respect, listening, and validating. How do you help your child develop self-esteem? Give them a sense of chashivas. Make them feel important. Now, they are important, but how do you make somebody feel important? Well, you listen to them when they talk. You let them know that you're listening to them. You respect them as people. Okay, they're not extensions of you. They're not their brothers or sisters' siblings. They're not the star of the basketball team or whatever it is. They're them. And one of the most effective ways for communicating this, other than by telling them that, is by listening to them and showing respect for them, asking them what they have to say about things. Now, obviously, you're not going to ask your four-year-old how they feel about the new president of the shul or whatever. You know, it has to be appropriate. But there are things you can ask your four-year-old for their opinion on. There are things you can ask your eight-year-old. Show respect for their growing up and their intelligence, for their ability to think. Validate their feelings. And here's a point where there's a point that I discovered many years ago that for a while I confused, and it became clear to me, and it's something which I think is very important to share. I'll give you a very, very simple example. Your child comes home and says that, you know, one of their friends invited them for a sleepover the following evening. Let's say your rule in the house is, I'm making this scenario up, but it doesn't have to be made up. Your rule is that there's no sleepovers on weekday nights. Because, you know, the kids go to bed too late, they don't function well the next day, that's your rule. Just listen to your child. Don't begin to scream at them, you know the rule, what are you coming to me for? You know, we've discussed this 6 million times. Yeah, I hear. Validate the feeling. You want to be able to sleep over at your friend, you feel that this is a special occasion, et cetera, et cetera. Even if you decide to say no, okay, that doesn't mean you can't validate their feelings. No doesn't have to be done in a way which makes them feel stupid or dumb or like, what do they bother to talk to you for? No can mean, I hear you really, really want to go, and you're not happy that this is the rule that I have. I understand that, but this is the rule, and I'm sorry that you're unhappy with it, but this is the rule. And the discussion can end there. They may have more to say, but okay. But saying no and sticking to your guns on decisions that you need to make because you're the parent in the house doesn't mean that you can't validate what they asked for, their desire for it, their need for it, how important it is to them, and their disappointment at not getting it. I've seen families, and this makes me personally cringe, where a parent will tell a child no and then expect them and say to them, it's over with, forget about it, I said no, that's the end of it, now go smile, and we'll play with your brother. Well, why isn't the child allowed to be upset? You know, if your boss says no to you about a raise, you know, you may be expected to go back to your desk and quote-unquote work, but nobody's hovering over you to make sure that you're not upset about it or angry about it. You're allowed to have your feelings. Why can't your children have their feelings? And so, no, I don't think your child should be in their room moaning all night about the fact that you said no to them. On the other hand, if they're upset and they can't smile and they're in a lousy mood for a while, well, that's normal. You just said no to them that for something in their mind that was very important to them. Allow them to have their feelings. Validate their feelings. If you feel that your child is sinking into their feelings and needs some sort of help with, you know, emotional modulation, you can say to them, you know, you've been upset for a while now. How about if we, you know, go out for a walk? How about if we play Scrabble? How about if we do something together for a few minutes? Meaning, your goal is not to show your child that you're angry with them. Your goal is to show your child that you have principles that you're going to stick to, and you're going to say yes when you think you can say yes, and you're going to say no when you feel you have to say no. And it doesn't have anything to do with them as people, as their worth, as their importance to you. Listen to them. Respect what they want. Give it respect. Validate their feelings, and then make the decision you need to as a parent. And yeah, there are times for parents to be flexible. Your rule may be, and I'm sticking to this example for no particular reason, really, that there are no sleepovers during the week. But let's say it's a special birthday, and, you know, and so they'll be tired one day. You know, you're allowed to be flexible. You're also allowed to change your mind. Okay? If you have a rule, I don't suggest for your relationship's sake, that you change your mind because your child whines and kvetches at you so much that you give in. That's not good for their self-esteem. It really is not. It's not good for your relationship with them. But let's say you say no, and your child either wanders off and sulks or whatever it is, and you're thinking about it in terms of, am I saying no for the sake of saying no? Or is this something I really believe in? Or is there a place here to say yes? There's nothing wrong with changing your mind. As long as you're changing your mind and nobody is, you know, crying at your knees or begging you, promising you the world in terms of they'll rake the leaves for the next year and a half and they'll never ask you for anything again. And, you know, it's like the father once came to me and said, I got so angry with my child, I told him they were grounded for a year for using their bicycle. And I said, a year is a bit much, you know. I was very angry. I said, yes, but you're not going to be able to stick to it. Plus, you're punishing yourself. You know, other issues, which I don't know if we're going to touch on tonight or not. Parents are allowed to change their mind. You are modeling flexibility and including other circumstances by doing that, which is also can contribute to self-esteem. Children who are flexible, children who can think about things and include circumstances and can make decisions are going to feel better about themselves than a lot of children who I meet that are very black and white, which is a teenage phenomenon in general. But a lot of children don't have that flexibility of thinking. It's also okay to apologize to a child, which I know that for a long time I heard parents say, what do you mean apologize to the child? They'll lose respect for me. No, on the contrary, it doesn't work that way. If you've... The simplest example, okay... And it can happen to all of us. It happens to all of us. We come home from wherever. We've been home, and the day has been aggravating. And we are in a lousy mood. And our 5-year-old, 7-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old comes home and does something to annoy us, annoy their brother, whatever it is. We get angry. And what we do is we dump the entire day's anger at them. And we lose it. And we yell at them. How could you do such a thing? You know, you're not acting like a mensch. What's wrong with you? All those things that we know we're not supposed to say, okay? And then you realize, like, 5 minutes later, when the child is looking at you like, what happened here? Or they've mouthed off to you, whatever the case may be. You're thinking, what happened here? Like, they did something wrong, but, like, whoa. I just railroaded them because, you know, I got a parking ticket or because, you know... my boss yelled at me, or whatever it is, or because I couldn't find what I needed at the grocery store, I don't want to make them, whatever it is that aggravated you and just put you in a lousy mood altogether. There is nothing wrong with going to a child and saying to them, you know, I was unhappy with what you did before, but the reaction you got from me was because I was about other things, and I'm sorry I yelled at you the way I did. And most children are very accepting and very forgiving when a parent's straight with them. You cannot do that all the time. If you're a screamer, and you're screaming at your child 6 times a day, and then each time after that you apologize and say you're going to have to do it again, you're going to lose your bank account with your child, okay? You can let your child know you're a screamer and you're really going to try to work on it, but you can't promise you're never going to scream at them again. That's honest. But to apologize and say you're never going to do it again when you know that for whatever reason you're a screamer, don't do that. But you are allowed to say, whoa, like, that made no sense. That was completely out of proportions here. You can also say the same thing to your child, by the way. You know, when a child comes home, says something to you, and then slams the door, throws themselves on the floor, throws themselves on the bed, throws the knapsack around, and you're like, what just happened here? So either you've got a teenager, which, you know, they do those things when they overreact, or there's something else going on, and there's nothing wrong with you saying to your child, I know you're upset, but your reaction really seemed like it was extreme to me. Is there anything else going on? And generally speaking, the child will mutter at you, okay? But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't say to them anyway, to let them know that you're aware that something might be going on. Open up the table for possibly later discussion. Meaning, this communication stuff, which is not the topic of tonight's session, is so important in terms of the child's self-esteem. And incredibly important in their peer relationships, as we'll talk about in a little while when we get to the peer pressure one. Number 4, children need boundaries and rules to grow. You know, I remember growing up, I grew up in Queens in a young Israel further out from mainstream Queens, for those of you who know anything about Queens. Like, I didn't grow up in Kew Garden Hills or Kew Gardens. I grew up in a community further out where we were sort of a one-town young Israel. And there was a family that lived there at that point that had a very interesting approach to discipline. It was called hands-off, you know? And I remember the adults complaining. I wasn't that little. That their children were really Vildachayas because the parents never disciplined them. Okay? So if they wanted to mouth off or kick another kid or whatever, the parents' response was, you know, they're children, they'll grow out of it. I don't know if they did or they didn't, by the way. I don't know what the ending was to that story. All I know is that, you know, when studies have been done and children have been asked, and children also have been studied, children need boundaries and rules in order to feel safe about the world, in order to feel good about themselves. If there's no end and a child can keep pushing and pushing and pushing and knows that they can be stronger than their parent, they can get what they want by whining enough, by crying enough, by being manipulative enough, and the parent just sort of closes their eyes and lets it happen, the world becomes a very, very unsafe place. In order for a child to feel good about themselves, there need to be rules that are appropriate and age appropriate. Now, obviously, rules change over time. What was appropriate to have a rule as a 6-year-old is not necessarily appropriate for a 12-year-old. But the 12-year-old doesn't need rules any less than the 6-year-old does. It's like saying that, you know, I'm going to allow my child to eat all the candy they really want. Won't that make them feel good? And the answer is no. It'll make them feel sick after a while, is what it'll do. If you allow them to have X amount of candy, even if they really do want more candy at that moment, you're being a parent and setting appropriate limits. Now, at age 5 or 6, you know, your child's not going to appreciate that you're telling them they can't have more candy. Honestly, they're not going to say, you know, come to you an hour later and say, thank you, Ma, I really appreciate that. I probably would have, you know, gotten more cavities and ended up with a stomach ache, and I really thank you for not letting me have more candy now. They're not going to do that, you know. Maybe it happens in some movie or another, but it's not, it doesn't happen in real life. On the other hand, children who were interviewed, and this is a book that you should become familiar with, by the way. This book is called Nurturing Good Children Now by a Dr. Ron Taffel, T-A-F-F-E-L. It's not a typical parenting book at all. And he's actually a well-known psychologist who practices in Manhattan, happens to be an affiliated somewhere between conservative, I guess more conservative Jew. I actually spoke to him once. I wanted him to speak for Nefesh, but he doesn't speak to audiences of less than, I don't know, 1,000 people at this point or something like that, and charges a huge amount of money. But he's worked with a fair amount of firm children, he told me. He definitely knows the culture. And he has followed children over years and done a lot of research cross-country with children themselves, you know. And children will acknowledge that they want their parents to set rules. They want their parents to know where they are and what they're doing. They don't, all that freedom that they claim that they want, they don't really want. You know, it's cool to say you want it. And it's nice to think to have it for an evening, maybe. But the fact is, like I said, the world becomes very, very unsafe if there is no perimeter within which your child lives. Again, that perimeter should be a rubber band in terms of your flexibility, in terms of changing with the child's age and needs. But if there's no rules and you sort of make decisions by the seat of your pants or whatever mood you're in or things like that, you're going to end up with a child who will either end up very, very fearful or will end up acting out. I see a lot of these kids who end up acting out. Why? There are a lot of reasons why kids act out. There's books written about it at this point. You know, it's a big topic. I've seen kids who act out because they're desperate to get their parents to react to them and set some limits. At some point, they don't want it anymore. By a certain age, it's like, you know, who needs you? But in the earlier ages, they're going to push the buck. They want their parents to react and set limits and say no and say, the buck stops here. And like I said, if they don't get that, there's a tremendous feeling of insecurity and a lack of safety, which is obviously connected to self-esteem. Okay. Number 5, the importance of hard work and accomplishment. Whereas self-worth is something that I think children are entitled to just because they come into the world, self-esteem, you grow into, and one of the ways you grow into is by achievement. Now, achievement shouldn't have to be a Nobel Prize winner. Achievement can and should be something which the child works towards. So a child who, let's say, is not the greatest of students and picks a subject and puts their energy into it, and you see them or you're helping them and they're studying and they're working towards something and their grade goes up 10 points from what it was last time, that should be a source of self-esteem. Don't let your child say, but I still only got A, or my friend got A. What does their friend have to do with it? Hard work and working towards something can be a tremendous source of self-esteem. I encourage parents who have daughters that are having difficulty to begin to let them, depending on the age obviously, to begin to let them bake, either with them or alone, to do stuff in the kitchen. Because I've discovered that for girls, for most girls, having something which smells good, tastes good for the most part, and the family appreciates, because it tastes good and it's cake, whatever it is, it's challah, whatever it is, gives the girl a tremendous sense of self. It's a very tangible accomplishment in some way. Come up with, again, know your child's strengths and weaknesses, and come up with things that they can begin to work towards. Help them, whether it's, if your child has artistic talent, you know, get them, it doesn't matter if you can afford lessons or not, don't get them lessons. Get them projects that are gradually harder and harder. Again, don't aim for 12 steps above their level, because they just get frustrated. But get them one or two steps above where they're currently functioning, and let them stretch and let them work. Because the accomplishment of reaching for something, whether they hit it exactly on the head or whether they're just getting there, brings about tremendous self-esteem. Which is why you'll see students in school who are very bright and don't need to work, who are not the ones necessarily with strong self-esteem. Because if you don't have to work for something, then it doesn't bring you much of a sense of satisfaction. The, you know, the courses in college, let's say, that I remember feeling best about were not my, necessarily my best grades. I did okay in them, but I worked really hard. Okay? I worked in college. I mean, I had to do my papers, I had to do my studying, et cetera, et cetera. But I didn't have to work too hard. The college courses, one of which was statistics, I remember nothing of. But the fact was, I remember working. I remember sitting at night trying to figure out what in the world was this lady talking about, and trying to do the work, and sitting on the test with a calculator that if you showed me today, I would say, it really is from Mars. It was as far as I was going to was then also, but I learned how to use it. Feeling like I'd accomplished something. That stayed with me. The other course was one specific Chumash course that I remember working hard towards in college. I went to Stern. And really working. And I loved Chumash, so it wasn't like I didn't enjoy my other courses, but feeling good in terms of who I was and my own self-esteem were the ones that I had to work more towards. And that they were not out of my reach, but they weren't so simple that I could just sort of review my notes and then go in there and not having given too much thought. I had to work. Now, I don't think I wanted 6 courses like that. I really, you know, would have been, you know, I wanted to not do so much work. But again, these are ones that made an impact on me in terms of who I was. It was the same thing with playing basketball in high school, but that's a different story in terms of working towards it and having the team work towards something and accomplishing it was one of the highlights of my high school career, which had many, many good things about it. And I did academically well, and I had very, very good friends. But being part of a team that really, really worked towards something, and in my senior year finally won the championship, you know, meant a tremendous amount. And I remember that last game, and I remember the feeling. Not just because we won, because we worked hard for it. We were not playing a team that was weaker than us. We were playing a team that was stronger than us. And so to work that hard and to sort of beat, you know, to triumph is a tremendous source of self-esteem. And whereas I can't say my self-esteem today is based on that. I mean, certainly hope not. I'm a lot older. But that feeling stays with you. And so that feeling of accomplishment and hard work really stays with you. The feeling, if things come too easily, I find people, kids or adults with poor frustration tolerance, kids who don't know how to have the staying power to work at something. Again, as parents, you need to know, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a bright kid or a talented kid where in areas things come easy. But if you want them to grow, and to really feel good about themselves, it's not just feedback from other people or teachers saying great work, you know, every time they get a test back. It's knowing that they've worked for something and accomplished, which is a tremendous source of self-esteem. Okay, number six. 25-2. Okay, we're going to switch in a few minutes. We're going to switch to peer pressure issues, but we're going to go on for a few more minutes like this. Okay, positive thinking can be taught. Now, there's a whole segment of psychology, which most of you have probably heard of, called cognitive behavioral therapy. It's the in thing to do, and the insurance companies like it very much. And it actually works for certain disorders. It doesn't work for everything, but insurance companies would like it to, because it's a much shorter therapy than other types of psychotherapy. It's very, very consonant with Yiddishkeit, okay, in the sense that you can change your thoughts and you can change your behavior and your insides will follow. The internal changes that need to take place will often follow. If your child doesn't think well about themselves or in general has a more negative view on life because they were born that way, because of difficulties they've had to overcome, whatever it is, they can be taught positive thinking. However, they need a role model. And so you can be taught positive thinking. And what I encourage parents, particularly with younger children, is to begin to talk out loud about things they normally wouldn't say. So, for example, when I meet six-year-old perfectionists, and there are a lot of them out there, you know, I encourage parents to talk about, oh, rats, that was a mistake. I shouldn't have done it that way. All right, I'll get it better next time. Or I'll try it again. Or, you know, to talk about the process of making mistakes and still being okay with it. Or the process of the positive thinking of, oh, I've got this really, really hectic day. I don't know how I'm going to manage it. Okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to organize what has to be done, I'll be fine, I'll be able to do it. Meaning, talking out loud about the things that we do in our head, some of us naturally, some of us not naturally, you know, but doing it because we all want to survive somehow, but talking out loud so that you are modeling for your child, what does a child do when they're feeling overwhelmed? What does a child do when something seems too hard for them? What does a child do when they've made mistakes? You know, what do they do if they make a mistake that can't be "quote unquote undone," which we all do. Also, you know, how do you bear that? How do you internalize it? How do you make peace with yourself? You know, what do you need to do about it? These are all things, thinking techniques that can be taught. A child can learn to be much more positive in their thinking about themselves if you will deal with them in a positive way. If you discover, and this is, we're going to talk about this in terms of peer pressure, believe it or not, that you have a child, and very often there is one or two children, one or two children that are easier for you to compliment, and sometimes there's a child or two children that are harder. Sometimes it's the nature of the child. Sometimes it's the child which resembles you most and has your faults. Sometimes it's the child which has your spouse's faults. And all sorts of psychological theories about which of the children that you have a harder time with, for whatever the reason. And you become honest with yourself and sort of make a concerted effort at being more positive with them in a very, very verbal, very active way, you will see changes in that child. Some of the consultations that I do with parents, well, most of the consultations I do with parents, I do not see the children at all. You know, if listening on the phone and sort of determining that we're not talking about some deep-rooted emotional problem that a child has, but rather there's a behavioral issue, there's a self-esteem issue, there's something going on which I would much rather the parents handle than to bring in an outsider as a therapist. I don't want the child in the therapist's office. I don't want the child feeling there's anything wrong with them necessarily. And I have relatively competent parents to deal with. My goal is going to be to teach parents how to deal with their children. And sometimes we can do it in one consult, sometimes it takes a few more, depending on what the issue is, obviously. And one of the things that you can ask parents to do and tell them that they should call you back in a month or 6 weeks and let them know how it's going is work on complimenting their child daily. Spending 5 minutes a day alone with that child, doing whatever the child wants, whether it's talking, whether it's nothing, whether it's, you know, watching a TV program with them, if that's where, you know, if there's a TV in your house, whether it's taking a walk with them, whether it's playing a game with them, whether it's sitting and reading together, separate books, quietly, whether it's having a child read to them, having a child read to you, whatever it is, 5 minutes a day of individual attention and compliments. Call me back in 6 weeks and let me know what the issue, what's going on. Usually, there's progress. Usually, there's progress. And I tell parents that if they're, depending how old a child is and how they've been living until that point, we're not going to talk about miraculous turnovers, but there will be progress. If there's no progress, I need to know whether the parents aren't able to follow through, or whether there's something much more deep-rooted going on with the child, or whether we're talking about a neurological issue with the child. When I say neurological, I can be talking about ADHD, attention deficit disorder. There's something going on which is preventing the child from, you know, taking in what's going on, or from, you know, using the parent as a, you know, in that way. But positive thinking can be modeled and taught, and guess whose responsibility it is. Okay. I'm going to switch over to peer pressure, okay, and peer issues. I'm going to talk about peer issues and peer pressure. Let me just find the next page. You have something typed up, which I apologize for the typing. Somebody, my Chayrachel was here, did it for me. The computer wasn't cooperating in terms of lining it up properly. I am computer literate to a very limited degree, and the more I try to line it up, the more things jumped around. And so if it's not lined up properly, it's because I am technologically inept. Okay, let's go over some of the basics of peer pressure, and then I want to talk about peer relationships in general, and self-esteem. Number one, peer pressure is normal up to a certain point. It's going to happen. And it happens relatively early these days. Okay? Whereas it used to be 4, 5, 6-year-olds didn't notice what their friends were wearing or doing. Many of them now do. Not all do, but many of them now do. And they want to have the same shoes as their friend. Or they want to have a certain brand, which, you know, obviously part of it depends on the schools, part of it depends on so many cultural factors, and part of it depends on your child's individual temperament. But peer pressure can start pretty early. And so let's first understand that it's a normal thing. And it certainly becomes, it's very normal when you're dealing with children who very much want to be accepted by their peer group and are afraid that being different is going to make them an outcast. Whether that's true or not, we don't even know for sure. But in some places, it is true. Okay, in certain grades, it may be true. In certain schools in Brooklyn, again, I don't know, you know, the Jersey schools. There are certain schools in Brooklyn, obviously, that I'm not going to mention by name, where I happen to know, because I've dealt with enough children from there, that they tend to attract a more cliquish group of kids. I don't think the school chooses them for that reason, but this is what it's come out to, and I see it consistently. There are other schools in Brooklyn that are much, much more relaxed in some areas, and the kids don't have that sort of pressure. They have other pressures, but it depends on so many things, including your child. Okay. Number two, the more a child is confident in themselves, and they need to have a self to be confident in. Now, that may seem obvious, but not, you know, the whole issue of self-esteem is helping. I'm going to do this 1 second, please, so I can, you know, I don't know if I can do two things at once. At least not without getting water all over the place. Okay. The issue of self-esteem is not just self-esteem. It's helping your child build a self, basically. A core self. Which allows them to have their feelings, which allows them to feel good about themselves, allows them to experiment, to take some risks, etc. The more a child is confident in their own selves, their own sense of values, and their sense of being valued, the more they'll be in a position to pick and choose conforming versus being more of their own individual. That's not correct English. Being more individualistic. Being more of an individual. That's better English. Okay. When you have a child who doesn't have a good sense of themselves and sort of lives knowing, at least internally feels, that they don't measure up, whether it's true or not almost doesn't matter, because that's what the child's perception is, because the self-esteem is not strong, because the sense of being valued is not that strong, their sense of their own strengths is not that strong, then they're going to be very vulnerable to doing what people around them are doing, so that number one, they blend in and they don't stick out, and number two, in the hope that whether it's the popular kids or some kids will notice them and be friends with them. The child who feels basically good about themselves, you know, may still want the same shoes as most of the kids in the class, which, you know, listen, what should I say? You know, they may be a little more expensive than you wanted to buy them, but that's not the biggest tragedy in the world, if that's what they want, you know, if that's the issue. You know, when the issue becomes they want to dress exactly like everybody else, and they want to do exactly, and they want to have, you know, I'll give you the example. You know, if some of the younger children, and don't ask me what younger means, because I don't, you know, this is not a world that I live in just yet, you know, are carrying cell phones, therefore your child feels they must have a cell phone. And you're like, no, you're not getting a cell phone at this age. There's no need for you to have a cell phone. If you need a cell phone because you're going on a trip, etc., then you'll borrow either mine or daddy's or whatever it is, okay? But that's, you know, the question is, what is the peer pressure about? Is it about a pair of shoes? Is it about materialistic things? You know, where I once dealt with a client that was in a school where the school was actually made up of populations from two different neighborhoods. One of the neighborhoods was more well-to-do than the other neighborhood, but most of the kids in the school, or at least it seemed to him all the kids, but I imagine it wasn't all the kids because they were coming from two different neighborhoods, had a fair amount of pocket money on them at all times, and had the latest in, I guess at that point it was Game Boys. I don't know what it is now. I know we've advanced a couple of stages, but I'm very behind the times. Colored Game Boys, advanced Game Boys, and the kids always seemed to have the latest. And it bothered him tremendously. His family wasn't even necessarily against it in terms of hashkafa, but for they financially, they did not have the money to keep up with whatever else was going on. That's one issue. What happens if... And I have parents coming into me and saying, what should I do? You know, it really does seem that 80% in my son's class, 80% of the boys in my son's class do own a Palm Pilot by the age of bar mitzvah. I don't want my son to have a Palm Pilot, okay? I don't want them, you know, beaming games back and forth. There are games I don't want my son to have, you know, and yet 80% of the kids in the class do have it. Well, what do you do as a parent? What do you as a parent do with it? When do you sort of say this is a values issue as opposed to a more material issue, and you know, it's about shoes and it's about you know, a type of pants or whatever it is, and there's even peer pressure in terms of types of white shirts I've discovered, you know, in terms of, you know, the brand of white shirts. I was unaware of that, but I'm pretty oblivious, you know. My husband says, how do you like my hat? And I said, well, it looks like a hat, you know. He says, no, but look at the brim. I said, yeah, it's a brim. We don't go hat shopping together anymore because I can't tell the difference. But he takes one of his nephews who are older who, you know what hats people are supposed to be wearing at this point. Not because my husband is so into fashion or style. He's not. He happens to be blind, and so he can't see what he looks like, and I'm of no help whatsoever in terms of looks like a hat to me, you know, so he takes somebody along who knows what hats are supposed to look like, you know. So, you know, there are different types of peer pressure, and as a parent, you need to decide where you're going to take a stand. You need to check out, okay, and I think I you know, wrote this here a little bit further down. You know, when your child says, everybody has one but me, does that really mean that everybody has it or everybody's doing it? You know, they're going, you know, when a sixth grade girl says to you, for example, okay, and I'm using ages sort of whimsically, that, you know, everybody's parents in the class let them go to the mall alone, okay? Or in Brooklyn, that may be a bigger deal than here. I don't know. You know, is it really everybody? Or is it five vocal kids in the class whose parents let them go to the mall alone? One of the things Ron Tappel talks about in the book, and it's an excellent, excellent book, is keeping in touch with, you know, parents, other parents from your children's age group and children's school. You know, because often you'll discover that everybody is, you know, 20% of the class. Or that the sleepover party, which was supposed to take place, you know, which your child swore up and down, and this is not this culture, but he talks about, for example, that there was going to be adult supervision. Well, number one, there wasn't going to be adult supervision, and three of the parents you call not letting their children go either, even though your child said, but everybody's going. So depending what the issue is, be in touch with other parents, okay? Decide whether this is a question, how important is this to you? Is this a question of you'd like your child to be able to stand more on their own 2 feet? On the other hand, you understand that a child needs to fit in to a certain extent? Or is this a values question? Is this a Yiddishkeit question? In the sense that there are families in Brooklyn who do not have any sort of computers in their home. And interestingly enough, more and more of the high schools, certainly the girls' high schools, are expecting the students to be able to print out reports on computers, since nobody owns a typewriter anymore. You know, Beis Yaakov type schools, you know, that expect the kids to be able to hand in reports, you know, that were done on computer. But there are homes that don't have computers, and they don't want computers in their home. Well, in that case, it's up to the parents to speak to the school, obviously. You don't put your child in a position of presenting that to the administration. But what happens when it's a Yiddishkeit issue, and you know that, you know, your child is somewhat different? So first of all, please don't send your child to a school where you are so different than the school that it's going to become an issue. But every family is entitled to have their issues that they feel strongly about, their minhagim, their culture, whatever it is. I absolutely believe that a parent is allowed to say no, even when it comes to issues of peer pressure. But investigate it first. Find out what the culture of the school is. Discuss it with your child. Don't say don't be ridiculous. You know, 11-year-olds can't have Palm Pilots, PDAs, cell phones, whatever it is, you know, or $20 in their pocket, or, you know, et cetera, whatever it is. No, or your own laptop. You know, again, different schools, obviously standards are different, both economically and in terms of what is the norm. One of the things you can work on with your child is helping them understand, based on a relationship, which includes a good working relationship with a child and a positive self-esteem, that no, their being different may not feel very good to them, but it's not going to kill all their friendships. Because if you have a child who's basically confident and is basically has friends, whether they're part of the most popular group or whether they're not, but has friends, being different won't matter that much. And I've seen this over and over and over again, okay? It's very rare that a whole class is going to turn on one girl because she doesn't have a something or another. Because I don't know that most classes are that unified that they can do anything, you know, like that. Classes are broken down into groups of children. Some kids care about these things because that's all they hold on to. Other kids don't. And yes, sometimes your child may have to deal with being the talk of the day. And that's it's a painful thing. And you have to go through your child, process it with them. What will it mean? What will it feel like? How will you respond? But the talk of the day usually is the day. And then kids go on to something else the next day. You know, and they will discover that they have not lost all their friends, and they haven't lost their standing in school, and they're still respected for what they were respected for, and, you know, whatever it is. But this is something you need to work through with them. Sympathize with their dilemmas, okay? Let's go to a different sort of issue, which occurs in the schools in Brooklyn, some of the Hasidic schools. I didn't know this because it's not a culture that I grew up in. It's not a culture that I am a part of. But evidently, you know, there are different levels of Hasidus in terms of what color stockings you wear. The ultra Hasidic, I guess, you know, wear the didn't know that there was anything called a thickness, a darn. I don't know what it's called exactly. I heard somebody ask for it in a stocking store once. I'm saying, oh. Is that how you get those really, really thick things on your feet, you know? I don't know. But evidently, there are Hasidic women who will only wear a certain degree of thickness with seams, without seams, and there are certain of those who will wear, you know, only beige that are not transparent but aren't that thick. And then there's the quote-unquote more modern Hasidic, whatever that means, because I bet many of them, and they're very, very Erlacha people and Erlacha Hasidim, that actually will wear, you know, different color stockings, you know. Now, what happens to your child, okay, if they're in a school where the overall, they're part of the Hasidic school for that Hasidus, and this is what's accepted, and this is what you do at home? Well, how do you deal with that? I think a lot can be dealt with
if there's communication between parent and child, if the child has a basically healthy sense of self, and the child has confidence in you as a person, that you are on their side, you will understand whatever the dilemmas are, you're not going to dismiss it, you're not going to put anybody else down, like, don't be ridiculous, we're not like that, or they're just being ridiculously religious for no reason, or they're being fry, or, you know, whatever, you know, they're not from, like, just like, you know, like us, whatever it is, but there has to be discussion, and there has to be a sense of, okay, what's going to happen if? Obviously, you don't want to do anything that's going to get your child in trouble with the administration, because it's a policy in the school, not a good idea, and not a good example to set for your child in terms of respect for administration, teachers, etc., etc. I want to move on. I'm going to stop to take questions soon, but there's some stuff from Ron Tafel's book that I just felt was so important to go over in terms of peer relationships and eventually peer pressure. There's a page that got Xeroxed, which about a third of it got eaten, which isn't terrible. And it's from Ron Tafel's book, and it's called Ask Yourself. If you have that page there, you should have it somewhere, I think. Let me tell you what that's about, okay? Because this is something which parents need to know. And again, it puts a tremendous responsibility on you, but, you know, guess what? There were studies done that evidently have been replicated numerous times that you can look at children as young as one or two and predict, based on the relationships in the house and how the child is related to by their parents, what their peer relationships will be like at the age of 10. So, if, as a parent, you, meaning you who's sitting on the wall over there, not anybody in the audience, obviously, are overly critical, then you're setting your child up to be either a boss or a korban, meaning the sacrificial lamb of the class, you know, the one who's teased and taunted. If you, as a parent, are basically confident, complimentary, you know, and are pretty good at, you know, giving off positive vibes to your child, well, then your child most likely will pick friends that are confident and thoughtful and will make decent friendships. They've replicated the study in numerous, you know, numerous times. And so the biggest predictor of how your child is going to fare in terms of their friends, assuming everything else is equal, okay, is what's going on at home. Now, I read that study and I was like, wow, okay, that's going to be a tough pill for a lot of parents to swallow. It's a very tough pill for a lot of parents to swallow. And so, if my shalom bias isn't what it should be, how is that going to affect, you know, my child? If, you know, if there's a sibling in the home, as I very often will get parents coming to me saying, I don't know what to do, you know, the 10-year-old is killing the 9-year-old, physically killing and emotionally killing the 9-year-old. You know, how's that going to affect the 9-year-old? Okay. Yes, of course, the question is what's going on with the 10-year-old. But sometimes they're not coming to me at the 10-year-old. They're coming to me at the 9-year-old. And the answer is, it's a big problem. It's a big problem. And we need to, you know, something needs to be done to protect them, to help raise their self-esteem, to help them learn appropriate ways of defending against the 10-year-old. And I'm not talking about karate, but guys, you know, but whatever it, you know, need be. That's the bad news. The good news is it can be changed. Meaning, if you, after hearing this, can look at your relationship with your child, you know, and it's, this goes back to, it comes from his book where he quotes the study. Again, I'm sorry if some of it got cut off. If my child is hypercritical in his relationships, do I criticize him too much? If my child has to be the star, do we too often give him the limelight, or do we not give him enough attention? If my child is too bossy with friends, am I bossy with her, or do I let her boss me around? Meaning, each of these things that may go on at home can go either way, because obviously your child's temperament will have something to do with it. If my child is picked on by other kids, do I too often criticize? If my child is a caretaker, do I tend to look after others and don't give anything to myself? Or do I expect my child to take care of me or another member of the family in the same way? If my child is an outsider in school, is he the odd man out in our family? Or are we a family that isolates from other families? take a good look at what's going on with your child in school, socially, who their friends are, how they're behaving, and look back to your family, or look at your family and see how it's being replicated in school in some manner or form at one extreme or another. And then decide what you need to do and do it. Because, you know, the studies are clear that these things can be fixed. Which is why, you know, when I deal with parents and I encourage them to really find the positive in their child and to work on the child's self-esteem and to spend time with them, and regardless of what happens, we ignore the negative for a while, unless they're killing somebody, you know, but don't comment on negative things for a while and watch the child change. They will change eventually, not only at home, but they will eventually change in school in terms of what the feedback they're getting from parents, from children and from teachers. I got a call recently from a mother who I haven't met, I don't know if I'm going to meet, of a 17-year-old girl that, from what the mother says, is a sweet, you know, cute 17-year-old who is appropriate, who is doesn't seem to have anything wrong with her socially, and yet kids don't pay any attention to her. Like the mother said, the child was reported that in the middle of a sentence, kids will walk away from her. So, you know, I have numerous things going through my head. I worked at a developmental center for 10 years, so I want to know developmentally, are there any, you know, is there something socially very, very subtle going on with this young woman that is more neurological in nature that parents aren't picking up at, because at home, you know, you don't see it as much. I have that question. But I also have the question of what's going on at home in terms of what role does this child have at home? You know, that she's wearing a sign in school that says, don't pay any attention to me, don't be mash of me, don't give me any sense of, you know, don't count me as important in some way. I don't know if I'll ever meet them because 17-year-old doesn't want to come. So, you know, I don't know if I'll ever meet them and get to ask the questions or find out any answers. I once dealt with a man many years ago, early on in my career, that his children couldn't stand him, according to him. He didn't have any friends. There was no shalom bias. And yes, it seemed to me that he wore a sign that said, kick me. He really did. Now, there was no sign on his back. But that's how he presented. The sign that said, kick me. Now, I guess I hadn't made the study then, you know, in terms of trying to figure out with him where that sign came from, the kick me sign. You know, so he was assuming that that sign, in terms of people treated him that way, because everybody treated him that way, so he felt that way. But it's the other way around. Okay, just to summarize this, and I really want to stop for questions, and I don't have enough time for questions. Your child has a style, a pure style, which is based on the child's temperament and how the child is treated at home. And this goes along the continuum. Again, this is not to, you know, take away from the child's temperament, because, you know, let's say a child is, you know, talented and has, you know, tendency to shine, they can be a leader and still be willing to share the stage with others, or they can be a leader and need all the glory for themselves. I mean, there's a continuum, obviously. You can influence your child's pure style, therefore, they're both their self-esteem and their ability to deal with peer pressure and to stand up to it when necessary, by changing your behavior with the child and focusing on the relationship at home with the child and parents and child and siblings. If patterns of interactions at home change, a child can internalize that, which means it can't be a week-long thing. They've seen patterns of friendship shift as well in school, in terms of who they're friendly with, how they behave with friends, how they learn to resolve conflict. They've seen all sorts of changes. Some of the suggestions from Dr. Tafel in terms of, you know, dealing with peer pressure, getting to know your child's peer group, make your home a welcome home for your children's friends to hang out in, get to know them, which means have a lot of nosh around. You know, be available, but don't hover around them. You know, be sure to have a sense of humor. Talk to them about things that are of interest to them, even though they may not be of interest to you at that moment, you know. Get to know who your child's friends are and become a trustworthy adult, which in today's day and age isn't as prevalent as we need to be for children. And if you become one, you're going to hear probably a lot more than you even bargained for. But it will help your child immensely if you know the peer group and if you know what the issues are, and your home is a home where kids are comfortable. They come, they go. Some homes become homes where sometimes the kids come over to hang out at your house, and your child that they're friendly with may not even be home. It can only be a positive thing, though it's not always the easiest thing to do. Okay, I'm going to stop because I want to take questions. I mean, I can go on talking, but I assume that somewhere along the way somebody's been listening and may have a question. So, questions. Good. Thank you for starting it off. Go ahead. Boys are actually harder, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, depending on sort of system they're in, there are a lot less things that are allowable for them to do, depending on their age. A boy who's good at sports, someone has it made. It's the boys who aren't good at sports very often who have much more of a problem socially and with self-esteem. You know, even the bright boys sometimes who are not good at sports, you know, sometimes have a difficulty. Very often, self-esteem can be built relatively easily. And depending on the age of the boy, a father-son activity on a regular basis can make a huge difference. Now, obviously, if the child hates sports, then it shouldn't be the father trying to teach the child how to play baseball. That will not help the child's self-esteem at all, unless the child really, really wants, in which case it can be done at their level with a lot of positive. You know, it can be, you know, we had a foster son who lived by us for a good number of years. He actually eventually taught himself to be decent at sports because it wasn't a mile of his. He was never great, but he became decent enough to be able to participate in the average pickup games, even if he wasn't going to be the best at anything. But he did have certain hobbies. He was excellent with Lego, a complicated Lego. And, you know, I would do puzzles with him together at times, you know, and we'd look at not big ones because I'm not good at puzzles, but big enough that they were challenging, and then we took pictures of some of them that looked quite real, you know, afterwards. Models, which I know aren't as much in fashion as they were when I was growing up, and my brother used to do them. Model airplanes, you know, model trains, train sets that you build, you know, things that involve a certain degree of creativity that aren't academic and can be done in conjunction with a parent. These are just some ideas. Taking a child who's non-athletic swimming, unless they're terrified of the water, you know, with the father, obviously. Again, I think that don't get me wrong, the mother's relationship is crucial, but for a boy to feel good about themselves, they need to know their father feels proud of them. It's essential. By the way, just as a, you know, you'll remind me of something, I'll throw it in. I think a lot of fathers may feel, and if they don't feel it, I'm going to state it anyway, that at some point, you know, with girls, that their relationship isn't as important. And number one, I've seen some research on it, but I also have seen it in practice, that the girls who do better, again, other factors being pushed aside for a minute, during their teen years and their teenager years, are the fathers who haven't withdrawn and should have relegated them to the mother, but have remained very actively involved and very loving, and have sort of been able to tolerate the child changing into a young woman and becoming, you know, developing their own gender identity without having to withdraw, and appreciating it in an appropriate fashion, obviously. These young teenagers, young women, tend to do a lot better than fathers who have a need to withdraw for whatever the reason is. That was just a side point. I hope I answered your question. It's just, you know, partial. I mean, there are probably many, many other things, but I know it is harder, you know. Yes?
Sports issue is something you cannot escape.
It's yeah.
Situation. I found know, a lot of us think we're classes, our kids are going to be classes, and gross motor skills are not that great. But when a child is taught some basic skills with the understanding you're not going to be a star, you don't have to be a star, but if the father at least provides to the little league or the basketball or whatever it is, it's like very simple skills, and the child will not be a star. But the skills are there enough so the child can participate. There are a number of children who are never exposed to it at all. It's written off, it's unvalued in the home, or it's a matter of, you know, again, right. I'm a klutz, I'm a son of a klutz, I'm a grandson of a klutz, it's my heritage. And the parent doesn't do that. It's almost like the chiyuv to teach a child, you know, to swim.
Right.
You know, that this is where they are going to be swimming. You're not going to be, they're going to be batting eight, or they may be sitting on the bench a little, but at least, you know, they know how to dribble basketball, and they know how to, you know, take at least a decent swing, even though it may not be where they choose them to spend their time as they get older.
Right.
And they'll find other outlets to shine, hopefully, whether it's within academics, within learning, within the music, they'll find the things which are valued later on, at least to get through these early years. That the child does have
100%. You know, I happen to agree 100%. Like I said, our foster son eventually, you know, practiced enough. My husband's not a big help because he's blind. He may have been an athlete in his time, but, you know, throwing a ball at him or having to throw a ball at you, you know, isn't really a good idea these days. And whereas I used to be an athlete also, it wouldn't have been real appropriate, you know, even though I don't live in Borough Park proper, but it just wouldn't, you know, my taking him to the park wouldn't have worked out real well. But he worked at it hard enough that he became decent. Now, the other thing is that there are, I think, more camps. I don't know in what age group, but certainly, you know, beyond the 7-8-year-old age group, that focus a little bit more on wilderness and outdoor skills. And they're good camps as opposed to sports. But I agree that for a child to have basic skills so they know that they can be a part of a team, as opposed to needing to sit and read a book or play with their Game Boy, even if it's going to be two other, you know. You know, I know of schools that there's the main group that plays ball, and there's always a group of four or five kids that are sitting around a Game Boy or whatever the newest, you know, handheld beep beep game is, and they're their own culture. And as long as they're not alone, it's not a terrible thing, you know. But I happen to agree that, you know, it's usually not impossible to give a boy some basic skills in terms of throwing a ball, catching a ball, you know, swinging the bat in a way that they don't hit anybody in the head, and you know they're going to miss the ball most of the time. You know, it happens to be very, very important because it is part of the culture, and them not having those skills, you know, sets them tremendously apart. So, yes.
I was wondering if you could give us a few pointers on dealing with peer pressure in middle school and
I definitely don't mind. Do you want to give me some examples of where you're seeing it more? I mean, the issues that are coming up in terms of the peer pressure.
Dealing with it from the parent, dealing with what's going on. Like you said, they have to be in touch with parents, but you also said at one point that the children don't want any more input from their parents. So how would you suggest that we build to that point where they can take it even though they may not want it?
Well, I see. I guess I'm old-fashioned in some ways, and I understand that this has to be done very, very differently today because the way I grew up or was brought up, you know, is long enough ago that it doesn't work today. Not that it was ideal necessarily, but it was a methodology which I think many of us were brought up with, you know, at least my generation, and it doesn't work today, which means I say something, you do it. You know, it doesn't work today anymore. And if you don't, you better watch out. Now, the better watch out may not have been followed up with anything. It didn't matter because we didn't test to find out, most of us. You know, I think that whereas that method doesn't work, I definitely think that parents should not so easily relinquish control because children say, but I'm old enough, I don't need you to make these decisions anymore. And I think what becomes very important in the middle school and, you know, high school years is to allow your child to have enough independence in certain areas, appropriate areas, that they feel in control and powerful in the areas where they're capable of being, so that the areas where you as a parent need to step in and say, you know, this is an area where I'm going to use my, you know, my parental authority and say, you know, I can't, this I don't allow. And the child can say, but I'm old enough, you can't do this, et cetera, et cetera. But the fact is, on some level, you can. Now, there are two scenarios. If the child may say to you, you can't do that, but the fact is, stick to your guns. Because if the relationship is good enough and your child has had the experience that you're fair and that you've allowed them to make choices, and you don't always agree with their choices, but you've allowed them to make choices where they can make choices, and you've given them freedom where they can have freedom, even though you may do it with your heart in your toes or, you know, going wild, but you understand that this is what you need to be doing for them at this point, then most children will respect that. I'm going to say something else that's going to contradict that. At some age, but it's not at 12 or 13, it's more at 16 or 17, you have limited control over your child. And whereas I'm not saying you shouldn't utilize and say, listen, again, this a lot depends on the relationship. You know, if you've had a good relationship all along, the chances are good that your 16, 17-year-old will have come to respect your judgment, even if they think that you've gotten stupider over the last number of years and you won't become intelligent again until they're 20 or 22. But if the relationship is good enough, they'll respect your judgment. Realize, however, that there reaches an age, and it's very hard for parents to swallow, where children can choose not to listen to you. And unless you're prepared to really physically fight with them, which is not a good thing, your power is limited, which is why deciding at age 15 or 16 that your child as a teenager still needs rules isn't going to work. There needs to be an ongoing relationship, an ongoing give and take, an ongoing sense of I trust you to make decisions. I may not always agree with your decisions, and I'll tell you if I disagree, and we can talk about it. And if you still stick with it, again, you have to allow your child to be able to make decisions, and you have to allow your child to make mistakes, and you have to allow your child to make choices that you wouldn't want, as long as they're not completely outlandish. You know, whether it's a haircut for a girl, which I'm not talking about out of the range of sneezes or out of the range of what's, you know, acceptable in the school, but you don't think is the best for how they're going to look. But it's the rage, and they choose to do it. Now, it may turn out fine because, you know, their friends all think that, wow, they've got the latest haircut, or they may come home crying the next day because they think they look ridiculous, but it's something that you may need to allow them to do. And this goes on over the years, and it's unlikely that a 16, 17-year-old is going to out and out defy you. But there does come a point at which your control over your children in terms of, because I said so, is very, very limited. And if you have not been inputting until that point, you're going to be somewhat stuck. If you've been inputting up to that point, then the dialogue can continue with more of, but I'm already, you know, I've got my driver's license, I can go anyway. Well, I'm not going to give you the car keys, you know, like, but it shouldn't become a power struggle. Don't power struggle with your children. Dialogue with them. I know you want to go. You want to take the car and you want to ignore what I'm saying and you want to go. But the reality is you can't go unless I go. And the last couple times you wanted to take the car, I did let you go. You know, remind them that you sort of have been, you know, rational, you know, all along. You haven't lost your head. But there are limitations. No, they're not going, you know, overnight with three friends in a car alone or whatever it is, you know. Obviously, at a younger age, it's a little bit different issue. It's an issue of going alone to a mall. It's an issue of traveling to a different town alone. It's an issue of three or four friends going to Florida together at age, you know, 14 or whatever it is, you know. It so much depends on the dialogue that has been built up until that point. It depends on the child's overall self-esteem in terms of where it stands within you. It depends on how you've treated that child all along in terms of respect and validation and being able to listen to them, you know. And then you can sort of deal with those issues as they come up. And they will come up. Yes. They will come up. And if they don't come up, once someone said to me, you know, is it a problem that I don't fight with my parents? Like, it was a 14, 15-year-old. Like, we get along. Like, I don't fight with them. Is that a problem? I said, probably not. You know, but it certainly is rare. Other questions? Yes?
Do you think that
Sibling rivalry is a minefield. Yes, it can be. You know, what most mechanchim and psychologists will say is that relatively early on, if it's a relatively equal playing field, we're not talking about a 10-year-old and a 2-year-old, okay? But siblings that are close enough in age, it's a pretty equal playing field, stay out of it. And unless they're killing each other. Okay, and if they're two boys who are roughhousing, that doesn't mean they're killing each other. Okay, but if it's an unfair playing field, okay, and you've got one child who's really just taking advantage of another one, then you do need to interfere. And the question is, why is that happening? Is the older one exerting power here where they don't feel they have it anywhere else? Are they taking out a bad day? Is it a singular event or something that happens on a regular basis? The general consensus is that as much as possible, if kids can learn to resolve their conflicts on their own, then you've taught them a valuable skill. And you've also taught them that you're not going to run to anybody's rescue really fast, and you're not interested in anybody tattletaling. Now, again, use your common sense as a parent. You know, if somebody's consistently getting hurt, and it's one person that's consistently getting hurt, or it's one person that's consistently coming to you and saying, you know, they're doing, my brother or sister is doing so and so and so and so and so and so, then you may need to step in. And if you need to step in, the question is both, how can you help the more vulnerable sibling to build them up? Not so they can sit up to their sibling necessarily, but that's part of it. And what is going on with the older sibling? You know, I've had cases where I have an older sibling killing a younger sibling. Sometimes it's jealousy because the younger sibling has it easier, seems to be more popular, does better academically. Sometimes it's because they were king or queen for long enough that once their majesty has been usurped, they don't forget so easily. And when things get rough for them, they take it out on the person who usurped their king or queenhood. And that has to be worked through. And I've actually seen cases where it really is worked through successfully, that the anger is very often misplaced onto a sibling, and it can be worked through with a therapist in not even such a long amount of time. Other times it's anger control techniques that one sibling needs, because what they're doing is they're aiming at the nearest target. The nearest target is a younger sibling, sometimes even an older sibling, depending on size. And they need to learn how to manage conflict and anger so they're not killing their sibling. Again, in an equal playing field, okay, meaning siblings that are relatively close in age and they're arguing over a move in a board game, and even if somebody upends the board and the other one starts shrieking, I can't play with them, you know, resolve it yourself, guys. Either don't play with each other or figure out a way to, you know, to do it yourselves. That's the best of scenarios. That's not always possible, honestly. And if you need to step in, but at least outwardly, don't play favorites. If there's something consistent happening, obviously it has to be dealt with. But don't put yourself in a position where one sibling not just feels, but really sees that you're always siding with the other sibling. You know, the fact that one sibling always feels that you're on their side, well, the other sibling probably feels the same way. You know, and that's a perception which can be dealt with by dealing with two of them together in a room, and also setting down some basic rules for them. But that's, again, assuming we have a level playing field. We often don't. You often have one sibling who is bigger, stronger, smarter than another sibling and is killing them. I'm dealing with a case now, which is a little bit unusual, where I have a 5-year-old terrorizing her 10-year-old sister. A very strong-willed, physically big child who, not fat, but big, whereas the other sibling takes after the other parent and is much slighter. And I'm not quite sure, I mean, I have a bunch of theories as to how this happened, but she manipulates the 10-year-old and chapters her to death. And this is, you know, and the 5-year-old is difficult in other ways also. This is just part of what she's doing. And obviously there's a problem here. And I don't encourage the parents to let them work it out. We're talking about a 5-year-old who needs to be contained, taught skills, figure out what's going on. Is it anxiety? Is it anger control? Whatever it is, that's not a level playing field, obviously. You know, so I hope that, yeah, again, I can't answer on one foot, but just to give you an idea. Yes.
Is there a guidelines about when it's appropriate, when it's not appropriate to encourage your child to be, you know, a kid, you know, in school, lay your hand on them in a aggressive way?
I think there have to be certain guidelines, meaning if something happens in school on a one-time basis, and you have to talk about your child this also, that fights will happen. You know, somebody on the playground is going to lose their temper. And, you know, if assuming we're not talking about a serious beaten-up kid, but a kid who gets a whack and, you know, whatever, playground stuff that happens and your child is at the receiving end, and it's a, you know, it happens once every four months. No, I wouldn't encourage the child to tell. I would encourage the child how to respond, not necessarily to kick back, by the way. You know, there's a machlokas, whether you teach a child to fight back, you know, to walk. I mean, how you deal with, deal with it. On the other hand, if for some reason there's a child, the teacher is unaware that there's a child who's consistently hurting other children, then yes, the teacher needs to be told. Whether it's hurting your child or whether your child is observing that there's a child picking on another child on a consistent basis, then the child needs to know. Now, again, you're hoping that, and again, teachers vary in all schools, that the teacher has enough seichel not to let the child know who's being told about, you know, how they know anything, okay? And you need to make sure that if the child who's being hurt consistently is coming to the teacher, that the child, that when dealing with the child who's the offender, who's the aggressor, etc., that you're not putting the other child in more danger. I mean, you have to figure out how to deal with it in a way that, you know, it's like dealing with lahavdil, couples counseling, where, you know, in your office, maybe anything can be said, but is there one partner who's not going to play fairly and is going to take it out on their wife when they get home or on their husband when they get home? You know, and the same thing is true in this sort of thing. You know, you want to encourage a child who's being consistently not treated fairly or is being hurt consistently to let somebody know about that. On the other hand, you know, when they're dealing with the child who's the aggressor, then the child who let the parent know needs to be safe. And, you know, I imagine the school has to make sure that that's going to happen. And the same thing at home. I mean, if a child comes and tells you that, you know, 4 to 5 days in the playground, they're being beaten up by so-and-so, then, you know, yes, as a parent, you take action in terms of being in touch with the Hanhala, whoever it is, because your child may have not told anybody in school. And whereas the chances are good, if it's happening on a regular basis, the school already knows that this child is a problem child, but they may not know that more supervision is required on the playground, or that the child can't be on the playground when all the other children are there because they can't control themselves, or whatever it is. So that sort of that's not tattletaling, basically. There's something called self-preservation. You know, if it's just that, you know, Ma or Mora or teacher, you know, he cheated in baseball, that's tattletaling, you know. And there are laws of Lashon Hara you want the children to learn, you know, and there are laws of, you know, the peer playing field that you don't, for minor misdemeanors, you don't go tell on another peer, basically. You know, now I know some children will take that to an extreme, which isn't healthy. You know, I can't tell you who did that. You know, we don't tattletale. But you just told me somebody's beaten up on a regular basis, or whatever it is, or this person is, I don't know, doing crazy, crazy things that are dangerous to themselves. I can't tell you it's tattletaling. You know, you get it both ways sometimes. But yes, there absolutely is a difference in terms of something that happens once in a blue moon, or is a minor infraction that happens on the playground, in the playground, you know, even not regularly, but, you know, periodically, and something which happens regularly, which is putting somebody in danger, even if it's the person themselves, you know, who's doing it in danger. And certainly if they're hurting other children, then children need to be aware that there is a time and a place to tell a parent or school. It's like I get questions when I used to do workshops in high schools, you know, what should you do if you think your friend is anorexic? You know, but they made me swear I wouldn't tell anybody. Well, if you saw your friend drowning and they said, you know, don't tell anybody, would you listen to them? You know, there are times when you tell and there are times when you don't. And that's something which teachers should be doing in school with children also as part of, you know, life skills, but certainly parents need to be talking about it to their children in terms of when do you need to tell a parent what's going on, and when do you understand that it's not appropriate to come to, you know, you with every little, you know, boo-boo that happened on the playground.
Yes.
Do you feel there's any birth order things that go on in terms of self-esteem? You know, the oldest have it easier or harder.
There is a fair amount of research on that. I don't know it. What I've observed is that oldest children, unless they're really born with more resilient natures, and some are, have it tough. Because as good of a parent as everybody may be, we still experiment with our first children a lot more than we do otherwise. There's no question. And when you see different generations of children in the same family, which I do in Brooklyn very frequently, the parents usually have mellowed a tremendous amount by the second generation. And I'm talking about healthy families, not where they don't care about the second generation of children, but their methodologies of dealing with them are just so much more mellow than the first group of children. I think firstborns who have the temperament of a firstborn, and not all do, take responsibility upon themselves inwardly, if not outwardly, feel a certain pressure in terms of living up to expectations, and get experimented with the most in terms of parenting techniques. And so I think really firstborns have a hard time. Youngest ones have a different issue in terms of if they're going to be spoiled, and depending on the degree of spoiling and what's going on, the word spoiling has so many different connotations, and what it means to me may be very different than what it means to you. You know, I don't think you can spoil a child by loving them too much, okay? You can make them too soft to exist in the real world, in which case you're not doing them a chesed. That's spoiling, which is not helpful. Meaning if your child is convinced that he or she is king of the world and then goes out beyond their Dalaramas and discovers that, well, they're not king or queen in nursery school or in kindergarten or in first grade, then, you know, you've done your child, you haven't done them, any, you know, you've done them a novel, you haven't helped them in any way. Middle children are a syndrome unto themselves, you know, and I think it so much depends on the nature of the middle child. So yes, there is stuff about birth orders, but there's no question in my mind that oldest tend to have it difficult, especially if there's somebody behind them, you know, a younger child who may have it easier in school, may have easier time with friends, you know, then it's excruciating to be the oldest and feel like you're being outshone by somebody younger than you and you're not living up to your parents' expectations, real or imagined, you know. So, yes. Yeah.
You said that self-worth is...
This is the last question. We're going to be stopping. Go ahead.
You said that self-worth is the foundation and building block, and that self-esteem builds on it. But, I think I see it, but, you know, with some of my kids, but doesn't self-esteem often... Can't low self-esteem or, you know, things that bring their self-esteem down be destructive to their self?
100%. Yes, it is. It's not, you know, I paint it in a clear-cut way, whereas there is more of a give and take. But a person's self-esteem can take a blow, and if their self-worth is strong, it shouldn't destroy it. If a person goes through tzkufa in their life, I don't care how old they are, that the self-esteem keeps getting pummeled. And I think we all go through those tzkufa sometimes, those periods in our lives when, you know, we sort of like, you know, look up to the heaven and say, you know, like, what have we done? Like, what's going on now? You know, somebody whose self-worth may be shakier is going to, it's going to shake. It's going to sort of like, what's going on here? What's happening here? So there is certainly an interaction. On the other hand, again, if self-worth is very solid and is, you know, and children know that they're loved and believed in by parents, they can feel lousy for a while. And they can feel, there's not such a word as untalented, but they can feel like they don't have any real gifts or no real strengths or whatever it is. But, and they may wonder why people love them. But if they know that they do and they're really sure about that, then they've got a cushioning which will see them through in some way. That's not to say that self-worth can't be eroded. It can be, obviously. It can be eroded by, you know, by consistently negative experiences with figures who are supposed to be helping them with positive experiences. It can be eroded in a poor marriage. It can be eroded by a sibling
who is consistently, you know, meaning if they're not being protected in some way by the same parents who may have given them that self-worth, then yes, it definitely can be eroded. There is an interplay. But I definitely think that children with, you know, a strong self-worth can weather blows to their self-esteem, a low test grade, a teacher who doesn't like them as much. And it's very hard. But if that foundation is there, it's easier. And that doesn't blow away so easily. We're going to stop because it's late. I hope this is helpful. And I'm going to turn off the microphones if I can figure out how.